Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine, sponsored by Phi Beta Kappa. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. You've probably met Stagger Lee in a dark bar somewhere, growling from the jukebox.
It was back in 32 when times were hard. He had a Colt 45 and a deck of cards. Stagger Lee.
Or maybe it was Ike and Tina Turner on a karaoke set. Or maybe it was the classic version recorded by Mississippi John Hurt in 1928.
That bad man, oh, cruel Stagger Lee.
Stagger Lee is the baddest man in town, as poet and critic Eric McHenry writes in our spring 2021 issue. And he was a real person. Maybe he didn't do all of the things described in the songs we just heard, but the bar, the hat, the gun have become mainstays of African-American folklore. Eric McHenry joins us on the podcast today for a look into the life and legend of Stagger Lee, which he exhumed through newly digitized newspaper records and troves of digital recordings, including the conversation between an elderly St. Louis musician and a 1970s graduate student that plucked Stagger Lee from a rich oral history tradition back into the written record. So thank you so much for talking to me, Eric.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
So you wrote this incredible piece of music history for our most recent issue, The Baddest Man in Town. And I thought, you know, there are a lot of different versions of this story floating around, but you have this line in the piece that says, you know, despite the tendency of folktales to grow taller, Stagger Lee's story has remained impressively stable over the years. So what is the core story? Can you tell us in case we've forgotten?
Well, the core story in the legend is that a guy named Stagger Lee, or sometimes Stagger Lee, shoots a guy named Billy Lyons in a dispute in a saloon over a hat. And he usually shoots him with a .44. And Billy Lyons pleads for his life and evokes his wife and kids, saying, "I have a family, please don't shoot me." But Stagger Lee is a bad man and merciless, and he goes ahead and shoots him anyway. And often their dispute involves gambling, too. And the dispute over the hat takes different forms. Sometimes Billy stole his hat. Sometimes he won it or won it illegitimately. Sometimes he damaged it or broke it or spit in it or something like that. But it's always a dispute over a hat. It's always Stagger Lee versus Billy Lyons in a saloon. And Stagger Lee always shoots him. And this has been going on for over a century now.
And it really happened, right? Like, this is a true story?
Basically, all of that really happened, yeah. In 1895, on Christmas night in 1895 in St. Louis, a guy named Lee Shelton, who was commonly known as Stack Lee, shot a guy named William Lyons in Bill Curtis's saloon in a dispute over a hat with a .44. And the elements of the legend that didn't seem to hold up in the documentary record were this notion that Stag Lee was a bad man, you know, that Stag Lee was this terrifying menace of the town, and that Billy Lyons had a wife and kids. He was, researchers discovered, listed as single on his death certificate, and nobody for a long time could find any sort of criminal record for Stag Lee Shelton. And so those were believed to be just elements of the myth that songwriters and storytellers had added over time. But as I started looking into it, I started seeing that there was real evidence that both of those things were true as well.
So why did you start looking into it? What struck you about this song, and like, why start digging into this historical record?
For about 3 or so years, I've been obsessed with recently digitized historic archives, and especially newspaper archives, and what you can unearth there. We're really in an unusual moment, I feel like, right now, where just within the past few years, these treasure troves of historic documents have become available online and keyword searchable for the first time. So if you're looking for something in an old newspaper, you no longer have to make yourself motion sick scrolling through miles of microfiche in some library somewhere. You can just enter the name in a box, and any time that that name appeared in the newspapers that are in the holdings of whatever archive you're searching in, all of those references will come up. And I started researching a variety of things, you know, my own genealogy and specific interests related to my scholarly area. I was looking for information about Langston Hughes and Gwendolyn Brooks and other poets I'm interested in who were from the area that I'm from, Northeast Kansas. And I actually found at one point references to Langston Hughes from the year before he was born, and ended up discovering that Langston Hughes was a year older than anyone had thought. And that kind of awakened me to the possibilities that these archives presented. And so I'd been interested in the story of Stag Lee and other pieces of American folklore for a long time. And I remembered that there was a historic basis for that legend. And I thought, oh, I wonder if I could look up the original articles about it. And I found tons and tons of articles. And as I started looking farther and farther into it and realizing how frequently Stag Lee was in the papers and Billy Lyons was in the papers and these other players in the story, and how much of the story was there, I started noticing, you know, discrepancies between what I was seeing in the documentary record and what previous researchers who didn't have access to these digital archives had concluded. And that was interesting to me, too. And I thought, I wonder how many sort of missing pieces of the puzzle I can potentially try to fill in.
So what was the lie? Like, what's true? What did you discover?
Well, it certainly looks to me like Stag Lee had earned his bad man reputation. You know, you know, previous scholars had said, you know, this legend that he's acquired over the years as this heartless, merciless killer, you know, he doesn't have much of a criminal record. He was sort of in the wrong place at the wrong time, it looks like. I mean, he was, you know, a guy that hung out in saloons on Christmas night, so he wasn't exactly maybe the most upstanding citizen of the world. But I looked and looked and I thought, well, yeah, no. I mean, here he is arrested for assault with intent to kill in 1889. And here he is again arrested for assault with intent to kill in 1889. And then again in 1890. And then here he is pistol whipping somebody in 1894 and in 1895, earlier that same year. And here he is committing a robbery, and here he is being called notorious. And, you know, the newspapers at the time were full of, you know, speculation and hearsay and racism. And it was an education in how irresponsible journalism often was back then. So I took everything with a grain of salt. But cumulatively, the impression was, wow, this guy was in a lot of trouble, and often for violent acts. And, you know, maybe the legend knew exactly what it was talking about when it said Stag Lee was a bad man. You know, the most impressive detail that I found, I mean, jumping ahead a little bit in the story here, but I was so struck by the fact that at the end of his life, Stag Lee eventually was arrested for this crime, went to prison, and died in 1912 after serving, you know, about 15 years in prison. Of tuberculosis. And at the time that he died, he had been given a mercy parole by the governor because he was in such poor health. And he never was healthy enough even to leave the prison hospital. He died in the prison hospital. But he had been paroled into the care of his good friend James D. Anderson, who was a humble junk dealer living in St. Louis. And so this was where Stag Lee Shelton was supposed to spend his final days. And he had, this must have been a good friend of his because he had willed all of his possessions to James D. Anderson. That was the only beneficiary in Lee Shelton's will, such as it was. But he died, and so he never went to James D. Anderson's home. But less than a year later, police raided James D. Anderson's home. I found this using the address of that house and discovered this giant drug factory, basically, like 200 pounds of raw opium. And police called it the largest opium and cocaine distribution plant in the United States or something like that. So here was the bad man, Lee Shelton, willing his estate to the biggest drug kingpin in St. Louis on his deathbed. It seemed like a great bad man parting gesture.
I mean, it's wild to me that like this one song and this one feud and these two people have inspired so much like historical speculation for one, and also so many legends.
Yeah.
I mean, you point out that like in 1911, sociologists were already, you know, collecting many versions of this song,
right,
which for me like really raises the question of like, why this guy? It's not like this was the only shooting in St. Louis or like in the country that
Hardly.
Could have been the basis for a song. Why him?
Yeah. That's the big question. You know, St. Louis at the time was an incredibly violent place for a wide variety of reasons. But that Christmas night was infamous in St. Louis for a long time afterwards, even irrespective of the legend, because either 5 or 6 or 7 other people were murdered in St. Louis that same Christmas night. And that wasn't a typical night, obviously, but that kind of violence was typical of St. Louis at the time. Stack Lee's killing of Billy Lyons was just a little squib in the next day's newspapers. Why did it become this larger than life, you know, enduring legend when all these other crimes, you know, faded from memory? And that is a really interesting question. It is not exactly the case that every other crime did fade from memory. There are two other killings that occurred in exactly the same neighborhood at around the same time. I mean, there was even social overlap between the people involved in these various killings that also became legend. One was the killing of Officer James Brady by Harrison Duncan. There's a song called Duncan and Brady, a folk song that has persisted well into the 20th century and has been recorded by Lead Belly and Dave Van Ronk. And I think Bob Dylan has done a version of it. I mean, on Bob Dylan's latest album, there's a song that concludes with the line, "You've been on the job too long," which is the refrain from the song Duncan and Brady, like he's lifted it from that song. That was a killing of a white police officer by a black man in a bar in 1890 at the same intersection at which the Stag Lee killing took place. It was at a different bar, you know, across the street. And that entered the folklore. And then just up the street a ways, a woman named Frankie Baker killed a guy named Alan Britt in 1899. And that became Frankie and Johnny, which is also, you know, a famous piece of American musical history and folklore. And all of them were kind of unexceptional killings in a way, right? I mean, you know, all killings, of course, are tragic and exceptional in as much as they're killings, but there was nothing that sort of shouted out, this is instant legend material here. I think St. Louis was a really musical place at the time, and I think that it was very, very common for the news of the day to be kind of instantaneously transformed into song by songwriters, and that may be one of the reasons. Why did Stagger Lee endure? You know, why did it hang around all that time? And I think that the reason is that it's, maybe ironically, because of the simplicity of the story, it has these few elements that make it kind of eminently importable into legend. It's a man killing another man in a dispute over a hat, which is a seemingly insignificant, you know, thing, but its very insignificance may be what makes it significant. This is St. Louis in the 1890s. African Americans faced extraordinary discrimination and social segregation. And boy, to read those old newspapers, you're just beaten over the head with the overt racism constantly. And it's oppressive. You know, the memory of emancipation and all of the promise that offered was fading. And it's sort of around this time in African-American folklore, as I understand it, I've tried to do as extensive reading on this as I can because it's not my area or expertise. It is around this time that the bad man figure first emerged. There had been other folkloric figures like John Henry or Casey Jones, who did these sort of admirable things and seemed worthy of elevating as heroes. But the bad man was offered something different. It was a black man who took no grief from anybody, tolerated no insults, did exactly what he wanted, didn't care about the consequences, and he would smoke you and leave your children fatherless if you mess with his hat, you know. And the Stetson hat was this kind of it was never referred to as a Stetson in the old newspaper articles, but the songs have always just been unanimous that it was a Stetson, and fashion would have probably dictated that a hat worth shooting someone over at the time would be a Stetson. And there's even a little argument in the coroner's inquest transcript that the witnesses recount about, you know, Billy had a hat and Staggerly had busted Billy's hat, but Billy's hat was this cheap little derby, it sounds like, and Billy wanted Staggerly to repay him right away. This is what actually happened according to the coroner's inquest. Billy wanted Stackley to repay him right away, and Stackley said how much, and Billy said, I want 6 bits, like 75 cents. And Stackley said, 6 bits would buy a whole box of that kind of hat, you know. But so Billy had taken Stack Lee's hat as kind of collateral, you know, until he got reimbursed for his own hat. I'm not going to give you back your hat until you pay me for mine. And Stackley pulled out his gun and said, give me back my hat. And some witnesses, it sounds like, suggested that Billy came at him with his hand in his pocket as though he were brandishing a knife, you know, or something like that. Or not brandishing it, but concealing a knife, but coming at him threateningly. But that is a little bit ambiguous. But in any case, Stackley shot him at that point. All this is to say, I think the hat is the crucial element. I think that's what lent it the potential to be transformed into a legend, that it was a story with a few pretty simple elements, and one of them is a guy who will not tolerate you taking his hat and will shoot you if you do. The paradigmatic bad man, the feared, you don't mess with this black guy, and he's kind of free of all of the societal oppressions that the rest of us experience by virtue of being indifferent to them, you know, by virtue of not caring about the consequence and shooting anybody who got in his way. One of the old versions of the songs begins, Staggerly was a bad man, and everybody knowed, when you see Staggerly coming, you give Staggerly the road. And that seems to be sort of the essence of the legend.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question of badness and of having a bad reputation or being a bad man is a really interesting one that you like trace through all the different versions. You know, in some he's absolutely depraved, and in others I think things are a little more ambiguous.
Yeah.
But then you went and threw a wrench into the whole thing by stumbling across the earliest known lyrics to the song, which makes for a really interesting comparison to what it then became over the course of the last 100 years.
Right.
So how did you find these lyrics, and what do they tell us about Lee?
Yeah, sort of late in the game, you know, as really this essay was being prepared for publication, I sort of stumbled upon this really early and apparently full set of lyrics that was printed in the Kansas City Star in 1897, in March of 1897. So 15 months after the crime and before Lee Shelton had even been convicted of the crime, these lyrics were in circulation and had already traveled from St. Louis to Kansas City. It was an article called Songs of the Jails, and the author was transcribing and reprinting songs just as a piece of sort of, you know, local interest or color, you know, or things like that, songs that were often sung by inmates in the city jail. And interestingly, an early version of Duncan and Brady was one of them. But there was this complete set of Stackley lyrics. It had been known for a long time that Stackley had become a song almost instantaneously. There's a reference in the Leavenworth Herald from late 1897 to a local pianist playing Stackley. But no actual published lyrics had appeared that predated 1910. And even the versions that folklorists had collected, there were no sort of attested early versions that were earlier than about 1904 or so. And even those, I think, were just sort of like sapphic fragments, you know, of Staggerly. So to have a complete set of lyrics from 1897 was sort of, I sat there in my basement at like 1 a.m. looking at my computer screen and just saying, holy beep, to myself over and over again as I was reading through it and wondering whether I should wake my wife and children. I wisely decided not to. But yeah, that in that early version, it complicated considerably my thinking about the song and its origins. I'm not positive that it's absolutely the first version of the song. It may have been just one of many in circulation, but its existence suggests that the Stagg-Lee song may have been born as a prison song. You know, like that may have been where it originated, as a song that prisoners would sing to sort of pass the time, as they would sing about other crimes, to transform other familiar bits of news and gossip into songs that they could sing together to pass the time in the sort of work song and field holler tradition. But in that version, two striking things about it are, one, it reports so many of the details from the crime exactly as they happened. So the person who wrote it was really, really familiar with the details of the crime, not just because this is so close in time to the time that the crime was committed, but because those details attest to the composer's familiarity with the crime. He mentions a guy named Charlie Mann twice as being Stagg-Lee's companion at the crime scene, and then is with him later when Stagg-Lee is arrested. That actually happened. There was another guy named Charlie Mann who was a friend of Lee Shelton's, who was, according to witnesses, with him both in the saloon at the time of the crime and was with him later when he was found and arrested by the police. That detail, that name, Charlie Mann, has never, as far as I know, appeared in any other version of the song, nor was it ever mentioned in the newspapers. I'm only aware that Charlie Mann was there because I've read the coroner's inquest transcript, and so I've read the initial witness testimony. And then the song, actually the very last lines of the song are like the composer's signature. There's that tradition in blues and folk songs sometimes that a composer will say, if anyone asks you who wrote this song, tell them, and then they'll give their name. And that persists into the toast tradition with Stagg-Lee. Toasts are sort of proto-rap narratives that were told stories not accompanied by music. And Dolomite, Rudy Ray Moore, had a famous version of Stagg-Lee that he would tell. And at the very end of it, he would say, if anyone asks you who told you this toast, tell them it was Dolomite, the man that's known from coast to coast. And so there's a couplet like that at the end of the 1897 version. It says, if anyone asks you who composed this song, say Wingy, the bachelor, the man with the broken arm. It's an interesting
very specific.
Yes, very specific. That's right. Yeah. It will surprise no one who knows me to know that I've been in touch with a reference librarian at the St. Louis Public Library who's trying to help me pour through old records and see if we can identify a wingy or a broken-armed man among the prison population back then so that we maybe can get the original. But the other striking thing about that version is that it's so clear that Stagg-Lee as a legendary figure has not begun to emerge yet. He's not the bad man, like watch out for Stagg-Lee, sort of the badass that you hear about in the later versions. Nor really is he the bad man with the word bad being used in a more sort of conventional or unironic sense of the Mississippi John Hurt version, the cruel man. You know, he's a bad man, cruel Stagg-Lee. The tone of Mississippi John Hurt's song is very sort of censuring or condemning of Stagg-Lee. But he's not a bad man sort of in either of those ways, it doesn't seem like. In the 1897 version, it seems like there he's kind of an impetuous dumbass. Like it seems like he's a guy that just committed a crime without thinking about it, and now is really scared that he's facing the consequences, you know?
Yeah. I want to play the Mississippi John Hurt version because it centers so much on the word bad. But I was just looking at the lyrics and the word bad does not appear in 1897 at all.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't.
The closest we have is awful crime. But it's like Stagg-Lee has done an awful crime, not like Stagg-Lee is an awful man.
Right. That's a really, really great observation. Yeah. Yeah. And I was crushed too to see that in the 1897 version, there's also no reference to Billy Lyon's wife and children. That would have been sort of the missing link. Like, look, it was there from the beginning. So, but yeah, that's right. He's not a bad man, even nominally, in the 1897 version.
So here we go.
Police officer, how can it be? You can rest everybody but cruel Stagg-Lee, that bad man, oh cruel Stagg-Lee. says the lion told Stagger Lee, please don't take my life. I got two little babes and a darling loving wife. That bad man, oh cruel Stagger Lee. I care about you, two little babes, your darling loving wife. You done stole my dust and hat, I'm bound to take your life. That bad man, oh cruel Stagger Lee.
Right, so here, I mean, it's really interesting because we don't have just bad Stagger Lee. We have that bad man, oh cruel Stagger Lee.
Right.
And you have, I think, you know, the babies and the darling loving wife from Billy the Lion in there.
Yeah.
Maybe to make him seem badder.
Right. It makes sense that, you know, if you are a songwriter taking existing facts, but you're going to add details in order to emphasize a certain aspect of the story, you would give Billy Lyons a wife and kids, or you would make Billy Lyons a pitiful guy who would say that he had a wife and kids, whether he did or not, you know, in order to appeal to your sense of mercy. I actually, the annotated version has sort of changed my thinking about the whole song in ways that aren't completely reflected in, you know, the essay. But there's this familiar couplet through many versions of the song that is actually present in that 1897 version. And it's like, boys, oh boys, what do you think of that? Stagger Lee killed Billy Lyons about an old Stetson hat. And in later versions, that's really that rhetorical question has a different implied answer. You know, what do you think of that? Stagger Lee killed Billy Lyons about a $5 Stetson hat. Like, that's a bad man. Like, you don't mess with that guy. He'll shoot you over something as small as stealing his hat. But it seems like in this 1897 version, the tone is, what do you think of that? About an old Stetson hat. You know, that old is interesting because it's kind of like, it could either mean this is an old raggedy Stetson hat that's not even worth, you know, making a fuss over, or it could just be like that dumb old Stetson hat, you know, that use of old. But in either case, it's kind of diminishing the value or the import of the hat. And the tone seems to be suggesting that Lee Shelton was this fool who rashly killed this guy over the most insignificant imaginable thing, immediately got caught. His last companion has abandoned him to the police. And then later, Stagger Lee is in jail and is complaining to his cellmate, like, I want to go to sleep, but I'm in trouble deep. You know, he's fearing the eventual consequences of all of this. And the last lines are, Stagger Lee, can't you see that it's murder in the first degree? Oh, how I wonder what they'll do when Stagger Lee has his trial through. So the song is sort of expressing that uncertainty and maybe even a little bit of sympathy for its dumbass friend, poor Stagger Lee, who did all these things.
Right. Well, and you talk about how this line here in the Mississippi John Hurt version, police officer, how can it be? You can arrest everybody but cruel Stagger Lee, really speaks to kind of the racism of the period, that like black victims just were not given the time of day.
Yeah. It's surprising that, you know, at the time a black guy could get away with acts of violence, you know, in light of the fact that there was so much racism and so much eagerness to lock black people up and so much indifference to the actual justice process and, you know, all of the horrors of American history that with which we're all acquainted. But the flip side of that was, yeah, as you mentioned, I mean, Lee Shelton, I think, was able to get away with a lot for a long time because his victims were mostly black. You know, he was assaulting or robbing people who had no social power whatsoever and for whom the authorities weren't especially concerned. And probably the reason that he was finally put on trial and convicted, I mean, it had to do with the fact that he actually killed someone, of course. But the person that he killed, Billy Lyons, was from a really powerful family. He himself was not super powerful, but his brother-in-law was, by some accounts, the most wealthy black man in St. Louis. He was the owner of several saloons. He was politically influential at the time as well. Henry Bridgewater was his name. And so there was some high-powered lawyers coming after Stagger Lee Shelton at that point. But yeah, the racism of the time may have contributed to Stagger Lee's ability to get away with so much for so long, which may in turn have informed Mississippi John Hurt's version, and who knows where he adapted it from, which begins with his memorable first line, you know, police officer, how can it be? You can arrest everybody but cruel Stagger Lee. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's listen to the second half of the song, because I think that turn that you were talking about of, you know, the jester-like boys in the 1897 here becomes gentlemen's of the jury.
Here
it is.
Boom, 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 winner 44, well, winner's by, Billy Blue Line is lying down on the floor, that bad man, oh, cruel Stanley. Gentlemen's off the jury, what you think of that? Staggerly killed Billy Blue Line by the $5 studs on hand. That bad man, oh, cruel Staggerly. Standing on the gallows, head way up high. At 12 o'clock they killed him, is all glad to see him die. That bad man, oh, cruel Staggerly.
So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of differences, I think, in the end of that song versus the 1897 lyrics.
Yeah. Thinking about it now, listening to it, I feel like he's beginning, although Mississippi John Hurt's version is, I think, focuses on bad Staggerly as cruel Staggerly, you know, bad in an unambiguously negative light. I feel like you can see toward the end of that song, the beginnings or like the sort of inchoate version of Staggerly, the bad man as he would exist later. You know, he says, standing on the gallows, his head way up high, at 12 o'clock, they killed him. They were all glad to see him die. Between his head being held up high, you know, like, and you see a little bit of the sort of pride or fearlessness or dignity there, maybe. And then this, they were all glad to see him die. You know, Beck, the musician, re-recorded for, I think, a Mississippi John Hurt tribute album, a version of that song, and he changed it to We Were All Glad to See Him Die, and I think got a little bit of pushback for that. I think there was a suggestion that the who are the they and who are the we, this is an important thing here. You know, the justice system feared a black man, you know, that powerful. And therefore, Mississippi John Hurt very intentionally said they killed him. They were all glad to see him die. Interestingly, when he re-recorded it in the 1960s, it's just now occurring to me, there's a verse that's not in that 1928 version, so that he must have added later, which is, as I'm recalling it, standing on the gallows, Staggerly did cuss. The judge said, let's kill him before he kills some of us. That bad man, oh, cruel Staggerly. And that too may be a kind of incipient, you know, the bad man who strikes fear into the hearts of you know, of all of the respectable white people who hold the levers of power here, you know, like that, the lionization of him. It, yeah, we may see the beginnings of it in that, in Mississippi John Hurt's various versions across the years.
Yeah, I think so. Like, what strikes me too is that it doesn't have the ambivalence of the original or the early jail song, shall we say, since there could be an earlier one. Like, at the end, it's not like it's, oh, I wonder what they'll do.
Right.
It's very, part of it might be because it's not over yet, you know, like when it's written. But at the same time, there isn't this like, and we're glad he's going to jail.
right.
And it's not like he went to the gallows either, actually, now I'm thinking about it. He died of tuberculosis.
That's been one of the most interesting aspects of the legend through the years, too, is that it for some reason, that was a fictional element that it was important, apparently, to have added to the legend, that he actually be put to death, you know, go to the gallows and go to the gallows proudly and fearlessly, as he does, I think, in every version of the song in which he goes to the gallows. And then some extended beyond that, of course, as it got, you know, elaborated on as the years went by and people savored telling different versions of the tale. You know, he goes to the gallows, he's put to death, then he goes to hell and confronts the devil and kicks the devil out and takes over running hell himself. And to this day, Staggerly is down there running hell. You know, that was the next layer added to the story as it, you know, morphed through the years.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, it's just so interesting how, you know, legends are born from fact and then they, you know, turn into fiction and we forget that they were fact originally. And then, you know, it sort of slides back. And it's neat to see it slide back. And actually, you conclude the essay with this like wonderful moment where you listen to John Russell David's tapes of that moment when, yeah. The precise moment you say when Stagger Lee stepped from folklore back into fact.
Yeah.
So we published it on the website. I thought it would be cool to play it too.
Yeah,
so
please do.
Here it is, that precise moment.
You know, Nathan Young has been spending a lot of time talking about Stagger Lee.
Yeah, I remember Stagger Lee.
Yeah. But I wonder if there was ever a person whose name was...
Stagger Lee's name was Lee Shelton.
Lee Shelton?
Right.
I never heard that before. Nathan Young didn't know that.
No, maybe he didn't.
Sounds so smug there at the end. Yeah. No, he didn't. But I do.
He was pleased to have that piece of knowledge, I think. Yeah, so that was Ed McKinney, who was a musician and sort of a historian of St. Louis. I think a historian, among other things, because he had experienced so much of St. Louis's history himself. He was, I think, 88. I determined at the time that he was being interviewed there. That was 1973. And this is a pattern that I think you see again and again in American folklore research, that the quote unquote discovery of something is actually a researcher finally finds the elderly African American who remembers it and can tell you about it. Like, it has not been a mystery. It hasn't been lost. There's nothing to rediscover because I've known this my entire life. It's just that it hasn't been, written down or published in a journal somewhere or something like that. And so I kind of wonder if it hadn't even really occurred to Ed McKinney so much to talk about, oh yeah, Stagger Lee was a real guy. His name was Lee Shelton, because he knew that. And as far as he knew, a lot of people still knew that. I sort of felt like my experience was an illustration of like the power of digitized historic documents like newspapers and things like that, and what new things you can learn and reveal with them. And I still think that to an extent, but this search also revealed to me, I think, the limits of that and how dependent you still are on things like the oral tradition and folk knowledge, in order to put together a complete picture, that if you're relying solely on the documents, you're going to get, a very, very limited glimpse of the total picture.
We have links in the show notes to Eric McHenry's essay, The Baddest Man in Town, as well as his annotations of the oldest known lyrics to the song, printed in the March 14th, 1897 edition of the Kansas City Star. I've also compiled a list of some beloved renditions of Stagger Lee, including the Nick Cave version we heard up front, and more on murder ballads generally. We'll be back next week. Till then, take care and stay sharp. Oh, cruel Stagger
Lee. Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.